Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson, sitting in for Ann this week. We all know there's strong evidence of a link between regular exercise and a reduced risk of cancer, but this weekend going for a bike ride could help eliminate that disease altogether. At least that's the goal. This Friday marks the start of the 14th annual Pelotonia fundraiser, where participant riders raise money for research at the OSU Comprehensive Cancer Center. And perhaps you know somebody who's riding, and if you do, make sure you support them because it really does make a difference. And we're about to tell you about one way that it is actually making a difference. Those funds are awarded to scientists at OSU who are working on innovative health breakthroughs. Our first guest is one such scientist. His specialty is lung cancer, which kills more Americans than colon, breast, and prostate cancers combined. But there is hope that a new diagnostic technique will change that. Dr. Patrick Nanasingam, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here, and congratulations on the grant.
Well, thank you very much.
I guess it's really kind of fun. We always hear about fundraisers for this and fundraisers for that, but then you're always kind of left wondering, does it do any good? But here's a good case where it actually is. The grant was given out a while back, but how much was it for, and how is it being directed?
So, well, first of all, thank you again for having me. As you mentioned, we received a Pelotonia grant about a year and a half ago. And really, the focus of this grant, it was a $100,000 grant. And the focus of the grant was essentially to support the development of a blood-based test that could be used for the early diagnosis of lung cancer. You mentioned earlier how lung cancer kills more individuals than several cancers combined. And one of the main reasons for that in the case of lung cancer is because individuals tend to present very late in the course of their disease. If you look in the state of Ohio, less than one out of five individuals who present with lung cancer actually present at an early stage. Mm-hmm. And that obviously has implications for treatment and for outcomes. So maybe 2 or 3 years ago, we embarked on a collaboration with the nanoengineers, actually, an unlikely collaboration about 2 or 3 years ago to start to figure out, could we develop a very simple, inexpensive, and accurate test that could be used, particularly in high-risk smokers, to help us try to determine whether or not a person who may have a spot on their lung should actually undergo a biopsy, or should they have closer surveillance, or perhaps maybe we don't have to be concerned about a spot on their lung. So with Pelotonia funds, we've really been able to start to test that particular biomarker, and now we're actually in the validation phases.
How prior to this, how hard has it been to diagnose lung cancer?
It's extremely difficult to diagnose lung cancer when it's at an early stage. When it's in a late stage, it often is not very difficult at all. Often a person may have a cough that hasn't resolved, or you find on a chest x-ray that they may have, unfortunately, a mass in their lung, or maybe signs that the cancer has spread elsewhere. So in the cases of late stage, it's often not very difficult at all for the clinician. Where we've had major issues has been in trying to diagnose people at an early stage where we can actually offer them surgical treatment and really which would lead to very, very improved outcomes in those particular individuals. So many investigators have tried to look for blood-based tests, have tried to use standard chest x-rays, have tried to even examine the spit that someone coughs up to see if they could find clues that a person may have a lung cancer at a very early stage. And really, for the most part, those types of studies have been unsuccessful. And it wasn't really until about 2 or 3 years ago that a large landmark study was done that showed that if you take certain people of a certain age and a certain smoking exposure and have them undergo a CT scan, a low radiation CT scan, that you can actually find lung cancers at an earlier stage and actually impact people in terms of their survival.
I'm curious, I've always been a nut about demographics. What are the demographics of the people that you're studying? Age groups, ethnicity, whatever,
Absolutely.
What are you looking at?
So the demographics really follow along this large landmark study, which is called the National Lung Screening Trial. And that was a study that was published a couple of years ago in about 53,000 individuals. And what they found on that study was that there is a very particular population of individuals who are really seem to be at the highest risk for developing lung cancer. These are individuals that fall in the age range of about 55 to their late 70s and even 80 and tend to have a heavy smoking history. In particular, people who may have smoked a pack a day for 30 years or two packs a day for 15 years. So we're really talking about slightly older, heavy smokers. And these are really the individuals that we want to target with our testing.
What about younger people? I've seen cigarette companies are marketing, more heavily towards the millennial generation. And I've read kind of anecdotally where we may be seeing more and more young people picking it up. I mean, I guess in saying that. How early is too early, to try and detect this, or are you disturbed by what you're seeing among younger smokers?
Well, you bring up a very good point, and that point is essentially that the number one intervention that we can make to curb lung cancer is to actually get people to stop smoking, and we really know that there tends to be heavy marketing towards younger individuals, towards other parts of the world right now, and that will only lead to higher rates of lung cancer and other cancer-associated diseases. In terms of actually screening younger people, we really don't have the studies to show whether or not that may be of benefit. So really, among younger individuals who may be at risk, say, for example, they have a first relative who may have lung cancer, or there's a long-standing history of lung cancer within their family, I think those are individuals that we should at least start to target, to counsel them and explain to them their risk, and then really try to aggressively get them to stop smoking.
Kind of getting back to the methods used to detect lung cancer, CT scans have been used in identifying lung cancer in high-risk populations. Traditionally speaking, let's kind of backtrack a little bit. Traditionally speaking, how has risk been determined?
Yeah, well, traditionally, risk has been determined by age, by smoking history, by occupational exposure, and also by family history. That's really been the way in which we've risk stratified individuals for having lung cancer. Mm-hmm. The problem with prior studies has really been that we haven't been able to show, or investigators have not been able to show, any benefit in mortality. So while previously they've been able to identify more lung cancers, ultimately people died at the same rate. So as a result, there was really no impact on mortality. That's where now the new National Lung Screening Trial has actually shown that you can achieve a reduction in mortality of close to 20% by focusing on a specific population with a specific test.
How about for those of course the issue of secondhand smoke. I grew up in a household where my dad smoked heavily.
Right.
My grandfather, who lived with us through most of my childhood, was also a heavy smoker of pipes and cigars.
Right.
I never took up the habit. It just always struck me as being kind of
good for you.
First time I saw an ashtray full of cigarette butts was enough to turn me off of it. But yet I think about I grew up in a household where smoking was almost second nature. So how about that? What kind of a risk group is that?
Right. It's a good point you bring up, and I get asked this quite often in clinic, whether or not a person who's been exposed as a child or as a teenager to smoke in their home has an increased risk for lung cancer. We actually know from several epidemiological studies that individuals who have been exposed to secondhand smoke do in fact have a higher risk for lung cancer, and it's anywhere between 10 to 20% higher than individuals who've never smoked. Right now, we don't really know what type of intervention we can make in those people. There are ongoing studies to try to figure out whether or not those people are ones that need to be targeted with a particular intervention, whether it's a CT scan or some other type of intervention.
Let's get back to the research you're doing.
Sure.
on this. You're developing a better way to determine if spots on lungs are cancerous. Tell us a little bit more about this, the idea of a blood biomarker, and I'm curious. In all research, you start out, and eventually you get to the point where you have your aha moment. So,
right.
So what was the aha moment for you?
Sure. So to frame the research that we're doing, one of the obstacles that we're trying to overcome is really this issue of false positivity. So when individuals who are high-risk smokers undergo CT scans, we know, based on the National Lung Screening Trial and other studies, that about 1 out of 4 of individuals who undergo CT scan will actually have a spot on their lung, and a spot that requires closer monitoring or maybe even a biopsy. The issue is that of those nodules or spots that are detected, over 96% of the spots that are detected are later determined to not be cancerous. So we started to think to ourselves, can we come up with a biomarker that can help start to tease that out a bit better and to try to minimize that false positivity? So for us, we started to test this particular biomarker. And I should mention that this biomarker really only requires about a teaspoon of blood. So this is not much. It's not very invasive at all. And we first tested it in just a small handful of individuals, about 6 patients. And we started to see some differences between people who had cancer and didn't have cancer. And then we subsequently moved on to a much larger group, almost 100 individuals, some of whom had spots on the lung that were cancer, and the others had spots on their lung that were determined by surgery to not be cancer. So these are people who actually, unfortunately, underwent a surgery that was later determined to be unnecessary. Mm-hmm. And in testing our particular biomarker, we really found that there were only a small number of patients among the non-cancerous group that had any evidence of the marker at all in their blood, mm-hmm. really suggestive that this was a very sensitive and a very specific test. So I would say that was the aha moment, where we had now tested in almost 100 people, and we were starting to see very clearly that this marker could distinguish cancer versus no cancer.
We're talking with Dr. Patrick Nanasingham, who is a researcher at the James Comprehensive Cancer Center at OSU, and who is working on with a grant that is a direct result of the Pelotonia bike rides that are being held around the nation, and of course here in Ohio, and we're seeing the beginning of this one coming up this week. So I'm sure the doctor would join me in congratulating those that are out there, pedaling, in some cases, a pretty considerable distance. I saw the map as they were going. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we invite you to call in if you've got a question or a comment. You can call in at 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And when you got to that aha moment, I'm picturing you and other researchers kind of looking at each other going, hey, we may be onto something. That had to be a heck of a moment for you guys.
It was really exciting. And when we started to share those results with some of our collaborators who had been involved in the research, they were really amazed at what we were starting to see. And at this point, it just made us want to test it even more. And we're now testing it in another 100 patients to really see how well this test holds up and how accurate the test is. So we're extremely excited about this.
Tell us a little bit more about the actual mechanism itself and what it does.
So basically, this test involves, if people recall high school science and looking through a microscope, it basically involves using a very small slide, the kind of slide that everyone has seen at some point in high school or another time. And it basically involves a small slide that is essentially coated with small particles that essentially are used to capture other particles that come out of the bloodstream. So we're basically looking for these particular particles that are shed from a cancer cell into the bloodstream, and we're using essentially a slide that, if you will, sticks to those particles when you pass blood over the surface. And then we can then take that slide, put it into a special microscope, and we can look for the signal. And that's essentially how it works.
What are the next steps? Especially after you get the second test group, completed. What are the next steps for this? What should we be looking for?
Yeah, so I think a couple. One would be to start to use this test in the setting of a clinical trial. And we're actually in the process of starting a clinical trial very soon in our screening clinic with the support of the James and also with the support of a grateful patient, a donor, who's been kind enough to support our program. We plan a clinical trial where we're going to start to test this particular marker prospectively. And I think that once we see, hopefully, that this is actually an accurate biomarker, then the next step would be to start to think how we can now test this biomarker at other centers, and eventually the goal would be to have this commercially available for people.
What do you think are the implications for using something like this on other forms of cancer?
So it's interesting you ask that question, because in collaboration with our colleagues, the nanoengineers, we're already using this technology now in prostate cancer. We're using it in liver cancer. Our plan is to use it in breast cancer, looking for slightly different markers, of course, mm-hmm. but the core technology is going to be the same. So if successful, this type of technology has the capabilities of affecting many cancers.
And let me ask you finally before sure. we take a break, what has to happen before this becomes a common screening method, diagnostic method?
So I think what has to happen is that this particular technology has to be validated in several medical centers. We have to be sure that this technology is reproducible in several medical centers among larger numbers of patients. So we would have to test this in several hundred to maybe even 1,000 patients before we would be confident that this is something that could be used universally.
It really is exciting news. And as you and I talked before, I mean, I've got some family history with cancer, although not lung cancer. But whenever I hear things like this developing, it's really exciting news to hear.
Can I just add one thing?
Absolutely.
So I just want to also encourage people, in addition to smoking cessation, to be screened for lung cancer. If you have a loved one who falls in that age range and as a smoker, we have a very active screening program at Ohio State. It's a program where an individual can come in and have a CAT scan and actually be seen by a James physician the same day, and they have the results the same day. And it's for a low fee that they can have this done. So if people are interested, there's a number. It's 293-5066. That's the James line. They can call to see if they qualify, and we can often have them in and get them screened for lung cancer in a very short period of time.
293-5066.
Yes, sir.
That's an
correct.
Important number to remember, and we'll try and have that number available as well for anybody that contacts us after the show. Dr. Patrick Nanasinghem is a researcher at the James Comprehensive Cancer Center at OSU. Doctor, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
This has really been an education. And a pleasant one this morning.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank
Appreciate
you for having me.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson. I'll be sitting in for Ann this week. Unless you live under a rock or on a private island, chances are you're stressed out. Maybe it's the rock that's making you stressed. I don't know. In fact, a recent study found that about half of all Americans say they've experienced a major stressful event in the last year. Stress may be an inextricable part of our lives, but for something so ubiquitous, it can be hard to really parse out what causes it and the specific effects on our health. But that's exactly what the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, NPR, and the Harvard School of Public Health tried to do in a recent nationwide poll. And joining us now from Princeton, New Jersey, to talk about where stress comes from and why it matters is the director of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Kristen Schubert. Welcome, Kristen.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Good. And I hope our show doesn't add to stress. So
there's lots of different kinds of stress, as you said, and this is a positive stress moment, you know.
absolutely. So give us a little bit of background.
Yeah.
What was the motivation behind conducting this poll?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as you said, I'm with an organization, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, where we care very much about the health and healthcare of all Americans. And our vision is to help build a culture of health across our country, really a place where being healthy and staying healthy is valued by everyone. And we have come to recognize very much that stress has a lot to do with whether or not people experience a healthy, happy, productive life or they don't. So we collaborated with Harvard, as you said, and NPR to start to get the pulse of, you know, all Americans and what they are experiencing regarding their stress level. And the results were really interesting.
Tell us a little bit about those results.
Absolutely. So we found that, as you said, close to half of the people polled had very much had a very stressful event or experience within the past year. And more than a quarter, you know, more than 25%, which is pretty significant, said that they've been experiencing a great deal of stress in the past month. And then you begin to wonder, as you said, well, everyone experiences stress. And what does that really mean? How do we begin to really unpack that?
Yeah, how do you define
the
stress and then begin to measure it?
Yeah, so one way, and there's sort of, you know, very technical ways that we can do that, but how I relate this to an everyday person is, you know, you could probably think back over the past week, maybe 2 weeks, where you woke up, and from the time you woke up to the time you went to bed, it was one of those days, right? Everyone
had a couple of those on occasion.
Yeah. Exactly. And it just felt like the world was conspiring against you. And, you know, it's the kind of day where you get to the end of it and you say, just going to take a few deep breaths and know that tomorrow's going to be better. I'm going to phone a friend. I'm going to vent a little bit. And what I say next is, now take that day and how you felt and imagine that that's your everyday, so that you don't get a break from the reality of your life. The next day isn't any better. That's what we call chronic stress. You know, that's the kind of stress when you're experiencing that kind of thing on a regular basis, those kinds of feelings on a regular basis, that's the kind of stress that can undermine your health and well-being over the longer term.
And this is the kind of stress that can revolve over things like money, health,
exactly.
You know, that sort of thing. Yeah, I was thinking, you made me think back to a prior job I had here in Columbus, working at a homeless shelter, and you know, thinking about, you know, being without a home, living in a car, living in an alley, living in in the woods someplace, and the stress that must go with that.
Exactly. And so I say to people, imagine not having the basic things that you need to support yourself and support your family. Or imagine living with a chronic disease that really, you wake up with it, you go to bed with it, and you know that it's not going to get any better. Those kinds of things, like I said, really do wear away over time your health. And so we're really very concerned about people who are experiencing that kind of stress.
Is stress a subjective term? I mean, could my stress be your relaxed, you know, kind of like, oh, you think you've got a tough life, you know, that sort of thing. But does that influence a study like this?
I think it does. I think it's hard to really put an objective definition to the kinds of stress that probably me and you, you know, experience. It is subjective to some degree. For instance, public speaking might not be stressful. It's stressful to me, but it might not be stressful to someone who loves to be on stage, right?
Yeah.
So I would call that a stressful event, and that other person wouldn't, as an example.
Yeah, they might say, piece of cake, no problem.
Right,
you know?
Piece of cake. Exactly. A new job, starting a new job could be exciting for someone and very stressful for a different kind of person. But again, when we start to really look at people who are going through those stressful kind of just daily living, right, mm-hmm. On a day-to-day basis, then it's not so subjective. It gets more objective, I think, because we see that what they're experiencing is really compromises their sense of safety, compromises their sense of happiness, having peace, being able to recover, being able to heal, and just take those deep breaths, that these things that are present every day are really not things that anyone would say are good things to have, right? Like not having a place to live, not having a stable job, et cetera.
We're talking with Kristen Schubert, who is the director of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and we're talking about a national poll that that they just completed along in conjunction with National Public Radio and the Harvard Public School of Health on the issue of stress. And I would bet you there are more than a few of you out there that are feeling stress of one level or another, or for one reason or another. But please, we invite you to call in to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News. You can reach us at 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, you know, in talking about the, you know, levels of stress, you know, I mean, and of course, being, you know, having people having different degrees and stuff like that, how do people put this in perspective? I often tell my daughters when they're going through a difficult time for one thing or another, and just say, hey, look, this too shall pass. You'll get through
this. Absolutely. And that's a very true, right? It is a very true thing to say in most cases. We put out that question to their listeners. We got, I think they got 6,000 stories or so back on either the kinds of stress people were dealing with, mm-hmm. or how people dealt with their stress on a regular basis. And so we hear a lot of what I just articulated before around, you know, taking those deep breaths at the end of the night, knowing that tomorrow is going to be better, relying on your social network to, you know, have some fun, relax, get out, have just a good, you know, person to listen to you. I really think it's about, we talk about resiliency, right? Are people resilient or they're not? And I think resiliency is all about being able to step outside of the stressful moment a little bit and say, just like you say to your daughters, this too shall pass. I'm going to be okay. You know, I'll live to see another day. It's all going to be all right.
We've got an email here from Pam in Clintonville. Pam is, says she is a doctor and makes the comment, our chronic stress is killing us. What can we as healthcare providers do beyond raising awareness?
Ah, I love that question. Because, yeah, this is really so critical. What we need to do as providers of any kind, so whether it's the, you know, family doc, or the teacher, or the daycare provider, is to start asking the question of what's going on in your life and how might I be able to help you? And it's asking the question and then knowing what are the resources in the community? Who are the other people who might be able to help the person? So I don't expect doctors to be able to house people or get them jobs, but maybe it's as simple as getting them to the right people who can help them is one way to start. You know, I was talking to a teacher in North Carolina a few months ago who had a little boy in her class who was all of a sudden acting out. It was a few months of, you know, just bad behavior and highly unexpected. He had been a good student up until then. And it took her about 3 or 4 months to finally figure out, through directly asking his mother, you know, is there something else going on? Come to find out that both parents had just lost their jobs, PhD level people, just lost their jobs, lost their home, and were going from sort of house to house and couch to couch until they could figure it out.
And it's the kid that winds up showing the signs.
Yeah, exactly. And she said it was so illuminating that if I had asked her that right from the get-go, maybe we wouldn't have had to go through months and months of trying to figure out why this boy was misbehaving. So to answer the question, I think as community members, we all need to be asking what's going on in your life and being unafraid to do that.
Health is as we've been talking about, is such a big factor, you know, in the issue of stress, and it almost sounds like the catch 22 because, you know, poor health makes people stressed, and then the stress causes more poor health.
Yeah.
I mean, that, I mean, yeah.
right?
that's got to be somewhat of a conundrum that really just drives you nuts and stresses you out.
Right. And the more stress you have, the worse you feel. Right.
Let me ask you, what surprised you, or was there anything that surprised you in this study?
Yeah, I think that over and above what we've already talked about, another element that surprised me, but it didn't really surprise me, but it was very interesting to see that people's social relationships also struggle. So they asked, how is this affecting your life, right? How does stress affect your life? And people said, well, it's really affecting my family life and my social life in that my relationships aren't as good as they could be, whether it's with friends or partners, et cetera. And going back to your comment about the vicious cycle, if you don't then have those people who in your life who care and you're connected to and you rely upon, that also then stresses you out and you're losing your support system. So I said, you know, it really does, when you put it all up, it makes sense. But you really begin to see how that cycle then just continues to spiral.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And people become more socially isolated, and they don't have that safety net, if you will, of caring people in their lives who can help.
And that kind of drawing yourself into a cocoon is
right.
Probably the worst thing you can do.
Exactly. It just, it's just, then again, more of the cycles, you know, it goes on and on. And that's why I think we need to very much start early. We need to really look at my portfolio here at the foundation. We focus on strengthening families, particularly families with young kids, so that this stress cycle, if you will, quote unquote, can be broken. Or, you know, families don't even, we hope, don't even get there, that they have what they need to, you know, manage their own stress, be strong parents, and raise, you know, resilient kids.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. It seems like when in most discussions I've heard about stress, it's always kind of, you know, by or about the adults in the room. We don't often think about kids, you know, feeling stressed for whatever reason, you know, be it school or bullying, things like that. How young do you see something like this happening? What age groups? How young does it skew, if you will, in terms of age groups?
We're finding out that kids feel, quote unquote, are affected by stress while they're in the womb. So it starts prenatally, and it particularly is very, very dangerous then and up through the age of, I would say, 2, 3, 4 years old while their brains are rapidly developing. So what do I mean by this? If you as a parent are stressed out, you are bringing that stress into their lives. I mean, there's no way not to, right? If you are very stressed, you're going to be exposing your little child to that stress. So things like living in poverty, we now know, really hurt brain development. And that's for a number of reasons, right? People who are poor, you know, it's hard to put food on the table. It's hard to keep a stable home. It's hard to even have the time to care for, talk to your little child. So there's nutrition, et cetera. We know now that's toxic to brain development. So it's for little kids. It's the stress that parents are under and their circumstances that affect the health and well-being of their children. And then as kids start to grow up, living in those circumstances, again, highly stressful, absolutely going to hinder their healthy development, going to affect how well or not they do in school, how they develop peer relationships, and it cascades and goes from there.
I mean, it's really particularly interesting because we just recently had a task force here in Columbus on the issue of infant mortality. And And that what you just said about it being even detected, you know, into the womb, struck me, because that's precisely some of the things that we were hearing from young parents and expectant moms, was the stresses that they were going through, in terms of a pregnancy that happened, and maybe they're a single mom, things like this. So,
right.
So it was it's interesting to hear you talk about this. Is there, we're going to take a break here real quick, but I wanted to ask you one last question.
Sure.
Is stress ever good?
I think there is such a thing as positive stress. Getting ready for that big presentation, getting ready for a big event, that is largely a positive thing that you might feel a little bit stressed out about. It helps you focus. It helps you deliver.
Mm-hmm.
But the key is that it's momentary, right? Mm-hmm. And that once you deliver on what you need to deliver, it goes away.
Yep.
And you recover from it.
And keep it in perspective. And as we said before, this too shall pass.
That's right. That's
Kristen
right.
Schubert is the director of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Kristen, I want to thank you for joining us this morning. I'm really eager to learn more about this and read more about this and maybe spread the word a little bit about this to some people I know who are particularly stressed out. Kristen, thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having
Great
me.
Great to have you here. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson, filling in for Ann. African Americans are 3 times more likely to die of asthma than white Americans. They're 50% more likely to get lung cancer, twice as likely to have a limb amputated than people of other races with diabetes. These facts have spurred what's become an annual event in Columbus, the African American Male Wellness Walk, which celebrates its 10th year at Livingston Park this Saturday. So you can check our website for more information on the walk if you'd like to participate or support it in some way. Joining us now for more on the role of race and health outcomes is Dr. Mark White, who is an internist at the Ohio Health Grant Medical Center, where he is medical director for community outreach. Excuse me, Dr. White, thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Mm-hmm. Good to have you here. If race isn't considered to be strictly a biological category, what role do genetics play in explaining the difference?
And the disparities, black versus white, say.
Right.
Well, I think there is definitely a genetic component to certain illnesses. However, when you look at the leading causes of death, such as heart disease, diabetes, cancers, there's a genetic component. But I believe that the overriding or the main factor that causes the disparities that we see in our community are lifestyle. Our lifestyles, the differences between one lifestyle versus the other. Mm-hmm. So while genetic definitely plays a role in what we're seeing today in 2014 in terms of healthcare disparities in African Americans versus, say, white Americans, I believe that lifestyle is a significant major part of what we're seeing nowadays.
How about physical environment? Because that kind of goes to lifestyle. I've read that that black Americans are far more likely to live in neighborhoods where air pollution is a problem, and therefore you start getting into a lot of lung-related diseases, things like that.
Great question. I think that environment definitely plays a role. In fact, if you look at the infant mortality rate in this part of America, we have one of the highest rates of infant mortality here in Columbus. And when you look at the environments that African Americans, not only in Columbus but around the country, live in, the chemicals in the air, the factories that they may live around. The air is not healthy air. It's not good, clean air. When you look at the types of jobs that we sometimes end up, factory jobs, where the buildings are old and set one up for lung, chemical lung diseases. And so environment definitely plays a role. And so it's multifactorial. Mm-hmm. There's a genetic component. There's definitely an environmental component when you look at our neighborhoods and where we live and the types of jobs that we end up being in. Mm-hmm. And so that so our environment definitely plays a role in the disparities.
It's interesting to hear you talk about the issue of infant mortality too. I had the opportunity to sit in on a lot of the recent infant mortality task force meetings here in Columbus, and one of the things that came up a lot in terms of talk, and it came up a lot with women who are either expecting a baby or had little children, and the whole issue of exercise, of being able to get out and, you know, just take a walk around the neighborhood, you know, things like that. But one of the things that came up was the whole issue of neighborhood safety.
Right.
That they didn't, you know, in some cases they didn't feel safe. So how does that factor into what you're seeing?
I think that it factors in, it really factors in a big way, because when we look at African-American males and we look at the outcomes of African-American males starting at the ages of 16, we see that there's a lot of violence. We see that the penile system is far. That's another disparity. A lot more African Americans in prison than our counterparts. And so when you look at this whole picture, if people feel unsafe to go out into their own neighborhoods, then they're probably going to be less likely to jog around the neighborhood. And when you take that back one more step, why do you see a lot of violence and crime and these things? And I think one of the things that the African American Wellness Walk, and why we have made it an event, a yearly event, and we've done things throughout the year. This year, we chose mental health as a topic to really zero in on, because I think that one of the things that you see played out when you don't have emotional or mental health, good mental health, is you see a lot of drugs and alcohol, a lot of violence, and a lot of different things are played out that have an effect on the community. And so what we're saying is, hey, there's another way. There's another way. There's other options. And that was one of the main reasons for the walk. We looked at it from the health disparity, but when we backed into it, we find and we see that it's not only in health, it's in the educational system, it's in the penal system. We lead the race in all of these different areas, and I think that when you look at it and think about mental health as being an issue, it's an issue, and it's something that we have dealt with directly this year from the African American male standpoint. Mm-hmm. I believe that as we have helped improve African American men's health, both physically and emotionally, you will see the infant mortality rate will start to go down as well, because now you have a male and a female there to support and nurture this fetus.
Mm-hmm. Given all the obstacles that are confronted, you know, in the African American community that prevent people from getting exercise, how are you still able to get that message across that, hey, you know, I mean, despite all of that, you still need to get out, you still need to to get your physical health in shape?
Well, I think that one of the significant things about this African American Wellness Walk is that it has raised the consciousness level of African American men, not only African American men. It was directed initially for African American males because we die at a higher average age of death when we first started out was 65. And so it was directed at males, but we have all women, men, children, everybody comes to this walk. And so as a result of 10 years of talking about health, letting people know that this is important, it's important to exercise, it's important to eat healthy, it's important to get the right amount of rest, and hearing it from all different kinds of avenues, people are starting to take a second look, and they're starting to say, hey, I'm going to have to make time to take care of myself. Because one of the reasons why the cancer death rate is so high in the African American community is it's not in some there's some cancers that are more prevalent in certain races of people, but the main reason why more women die of breast African American women die of breast cancer, more African American men die of prostate cancer is because they get to the doctor too late. Mm-hmm. And so I think as a result of the walk, and I actually know it as a result of the walk, more men, more women are coming in for these screening of the breasts, prostate cancer, colonoscopy, because we're pushing that. We're pushing that in our neighborhoods.
And let me remind people, we're talking with Dr. Mark White, who is an internist at the Ohio Health Grant Medical Center, where he is the medical director for community outreach. And we're talking about the wellness walk, the African-American male wellness walk, which is going to be coming up. And if you want to call in and you've got a question or a comment that you'd like to ask Dr. White, you can call us in at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. White, listening to you talk about the wellness walk and the successes that you've had over 10 years, I wonder, is there a way to take this from being a walk that happens once a year to a walk that happens every month, every week, every day? I mean, how do you basically take this down from being a community-wide walk down to, hey, let's get a group of people and let's walk, get your neighbors, let's walk together, right, every morning or every evening?
Absolutely. One of the things that when we first, at the end of the first walk, it was a one event kind of thing. It was a good event. People came out. And then we started, as the years went by, we started doing things throughout the year. So it's not a one-time event. So I want to make sure that I emphasize that it's not a one-time event. We do things throughout the year. And we've done a lot this year. Again, we've focused in on mental health because we believe that that's an important point. And I think one of the things that I, from the walk, this has been going on for a decade, and not one negative thing has ever come out of it in terms of violence or anything, any negativity towards that, which I think is, you always see in the news, black on black crime and right, this and that. But this walk has gone for 10 years and there's never been a negative any negativity.
And again, it's another way for people in the community to take charge of a major issue.
Right. And we have shown that African American men can come together for a significant problem in our community and make a difference. And I believe we have made a big difference.
And before we go, I want you to tell us kind of the particulars on the walk this year, When is it, what's the gathering spot, where does it kick off from?
Okay, so it is this Saturday, August the 9th. The screenings, there'll be all screenings from diabetes, high blood pressure, mammograms, HIV, mental health screenings, just about any kind of screening you can think of. It will be located in front of Nationwide Children's Hospital.
Are those free screenings, by the way, too?
Those are free screenings.
That's good to know.
There'll be, there's some, anywhere from, I think, about 20 African-American doctors will be there to answer questions.
Dr. White, thank you very much. Dr. Mark White is an internist at the Ohio Health Grant Medical Center, and we thank you for joining us today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.